to another edition of Sunday Unpacked. Today is May 20th, and we're talking about May 18th sermon, the story of God's love, a people, and we're going to address the topic of rescue. This is Monica Walmsley, and I'm here with Pastor James today.
Hello. Yeah.
How's it going?
It's good. Good. We're sort of in the middle of, we might have a little storm, so if you hear some thunder, hey, it's just, well, adds to the drama, right?
It does, yes, because there's a lot of drama in this one, a lot of drama. And you covered
Actually, there's a lot of territory. In next week's passage, so the thunder would be better for next week. Too bad. Next week, yeah.
Well, you never know. It is spring in Illinois. We may have another storm next week. So the story of God's love, the rescue is what we're talking about today. And of course, we're in the book of Exodus, and you're going to cover chapters 11 through 15.
Correct.
And I'm just going to, I've got a few questions from, at least one question from each chapter, I believe.
Okay.
And it's not.
Don't do that next week because we're going to cover 19 to 31.
Oh, so, okay. Good. Thanks for letting me know.
Obligated to do a question on the priestly vestments or something.
Oh, yeah. You know? So we're going to, you covered a lot of ground. And so and next week we're going to cover a lot of ground too. And apparently the Israelites covered a lot of ground because they went forward, back, and around and ended up in front of the sea. Did you get any questions? I did not get any questions.
Okay. Nope.
All right. So you can still text those questions to 404-565-4498 and email questions to questions@taylorvillechristian.com, or you can fill them out on your Connect card and hand it in the offering plate. And I think we'll talk a little bit about upcoming podcasts when we get to the last question of what's next. Okay. So chapter 11 tells us about the final plague warning to Pharaoh. And we all know that that is the death of the firstborn. And when Moses went to Pharaoh and told him about what was going to happen and Pharaoh refused to listen, Moses left angry in verse 8. Why was he angry?
And I think, see, I should have pulled it up, but it's not just angry. It's like very angry or something.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Yeah. Did you?
Hot with anger.
Hot with anger. Have you ever been hot with anger?
Oh, yeah, probably so.
Yeah.
Probably so. I don't like to be angry, though.
No, I don't either. It makes me cry.
So why was he so angry? And it makes a point of saying it. So it must be important, you know? And we're not told exactly why. So we got to use a little bit of our creative imagination to, to think through that. But it, for me, as I think about that, he's angry that Pharaoh has come so close so many times during the process of these 10 plagues and the 9 that have already happened and then changes his mind. And, you know, I don't think Moses has some enjoyment here on these bad things happening to the people of Egypt. It's not fun. It wouldn't have been fun to watch. It would have been hard to watch. And, you know, I think he's angry because Pharaoh has refused to relent to what God has called him to do. And here we are, and it's going to be even worse, you know? Yeah. And I don't think Moses relishes that, but he knows God's got to act to get the people out of Egypt, out of slavery, and then moving toward the promised land. So that's my guess. But I mean, it is really just a guess because we're not told.
Right. And so I just want to say or ask a question. Moses was doing what God wanted him to do.
Yeah. I think God tells him to go talk to Pharaoh.
And it's not a positive outcome. And Moses is anger. He's mad. He's just mad. And so I think it's important to remember that it doesn't say that following that, that God was mad at Moses for being angry anywhere,
Not at this point.
So Moses's emotion wasn't necessarily a sin.
No. Now, later on, he acts in anger and it does create a problem, you know,
right.
But that's not, it's not identified as such in this part of the story at all.
Yeah. So Moses goes back to the people and just says, hey, let's start preparing. And that gets us to chapter 12, which is kind of a preparation for, number one, the first Passover. And it
right.
clearly and publicly sets God's people apart from the other people in that land.
Right, and primarily at the moment from the Egyptians, but it will be a marker for them.
For the rest.
As they move forward.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So what does the Passover symbolize in the lives of the Israelites? And what relevance does it have on the life of a modern Christian?
For ancient Israelites, I think that this represents, this is Independence Day.
Mm-hmm.
This is when they get out of Egypt, out of slavery. So it represents that freedom, but it also represents the power of God, right? Because it's only the power of God that delivers them from that slavery. So this represents God at work to bring them freedom. And that will be a reminder every year when they celebrate the Passover feast that God has worked on their behalf and that God has brought them freedom. And in fact, we'll talk about this a bit more this coming Sunday, that God says in chapter 19, after this is all over, remember what I did to bring you out of slavery in Egypt. And because of that, I'm calling you into this relationship. And so it sort of forms the basis for the covenant that's about to happen. And that really is 19 to 31. So this points forward, it points, you know, this meal will point backward to this day when it happens, but it also points forward at this point to what God is about to do, which is to call the people of Israel into a special relationship with him, unlike what anyone else has. So there's that. And then, you know, if we think about how it affects us, I mean, Jesus was crucified at the beginning of Passover, and mm-hmm. we're talking about deliverance once again and freedom and the power over the things that would bind us. So as we think about Passover, I think those things have to be associated with what Christ has given us as well.
Mm-hmm. I think it's amazing that we still celebrate that today. And
right.
we don't have to sacrifice animals and paint our doorways, doorposts, and that with the blood of a lamb, because we have the blood of the lamb inside of us. And I
right.
just think that's, it just puts it all together and just makes me identify with them. Like I couldn't understand what they lived through, but I also can't understand what Jesus lived through. So
sure.
it just, it's very, very intriguing to me.
And, you know, if we take it a step further, our communion that we celebrate every Sunday, I mean, it comes out of a part of that Passover mm-hmm. meal, and Jesus institutes it in the middle of that. So, I mean, we have a marker of that, not every year, but every week when we
right.
take communion together.
Yeah. So in chapter 11, Moses instructs the people to ask their neighbors for articles of silver and gold.
Mm-hmm.
And in chapter 12, we find out that they were very generous. The Egyptians were very generous during the Israelites' departure. So kind of how does this generosity during their departure illustrate the concept of restitution?
It must be that the people of Egypt saw that the people of Israel were being, you know, mistreated in their own land and taken advantage of for the purposes of Egypt. And so they must have some kind of compassion, because it says that they're disposed to them or something to that effect, mm-hmm. that kind of language. And so they're willing to give them possessions as they prepare to leave. And maybe restitution is the right word. I think God is providing for his people. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember that on the other end of this, when God does call Moses to have the people construct the tabernacle, what do? Well, they give their articles of gold and silver and things of that nature, the valuable things they have to construct the tabernacle. Well, I think there's a real good chance that some of those things that were used in the construction of the tabernacle are some of these things that are given by the people of Egypt to the Israelites. So there's a certain irony that even the Egyptians are participating in building the worship structure for the God of the Israelites. It just happens later on. So God's at work all the way through this, making provision for what is yet to be.
Yeah, I think that's very cool. How can the deliverance of the Israelites from Egypt inspire us in times of personal adversity? I think there are many ways, but...
Yeah, there's probably a long list of things that we could talk about there. At the top of that list for me is the fact that God sees their suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So we read that the cry of the Israelites reaches to God, that they've been oppressed, they've been mistreated, and God pays attention to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good thing for us to remember, that God cares about the suffering of humans. He created us, he made us, he sustains our lives, and he doesn't want us to be in pain, especially at the hands of another person. So part of the lesson here is God does pay attention to that suffering. So if we're in the middle of that suffering, we can be confident, number one, that we're not in it alone, and that God really does care about what we're going through. So we don't have to face all that feeling like, hey, you know, first of all, nobody cares, or I'm doing this alone. God is there with us.
Mm-hmm. I like that. That's so good. So Exodus 12:31-51, the 10th plague hits Egypt.
Right.
Pharaoh and all of Egypt is affected, even their livestock. And he demands that Moses and the Israelites leave at once.
Right.
Were they prepared, the Israelites?
Yeah, I think that's what the Passover is all about, right? They ate the Passover, shoes on, travel clothes on, ready to go, everything packed. So as soon as word came that Pharaoh is ready for them to leave, the people of Israel are ready to go. So yeah. God has prepared them for this specific moment to do what God needs them to do.
In verse 38, says that many other people went with them. And if you want to read that verse, that would be great. My question is, who are the many other people?
So it tells us in verse 37 that there are 600,000 men, besides the women and children, among the people of Israel who set out. And then 38, many other people went up with them, and also large droves of livestock, both flocks and herds. So who are these many other people? Who are we talking about here? Well, again, we're not told, but if we think about what's our best guess on this, it could include some Egyptians who have a sense of affinity for the Israelites and what they've been through. I think more likely what you have are other groups of people in Egypt who are not Egyptians, people who are immigrants of some kind who have come to Egypt, probably very much like the same story as the family of Jacob who come because there's a famine in their land and they end up staying in Egypt. And it may be that other people were oppressed along with the Israelites. I mean, I don't really know a lot about that history, but it may be that some of these people see what God is doing and they're ready to jump in with God's people to find freedom outside of the slavery in Egypt. So I think that's my best guess. What's going on is that you've got other quote unquote foreigners to the land of Egypt who are ready to leave just like the people of Israel. And here's their chance.
I have wondered when I've read that, and I love your explanation. I've wondered if maybe it might be some Egyptians who saw that God's hand the Israelites. Right. And they're like, hey, he has shown power over Pharaoh time and again. And if I want to follow someone who is powerful, this is who I want to follow.
Yep. It very well could be that. I mean, again, we don't know for mm-hmm. sure, but that makes just as much sense as what I said. So either one of those, yeah. I think, are possible. It may have been people from both of those groups.
Yeah. You had mentioned that there were 600,000 men.
Right.
And that's not counting the children and the women. Can right. you imagine how big that group must have looked like?
This is a lot of people. Yeah. I mean, this is a lot of people yeah. on the move. And it would have taken them a long time to go anywhere. And it would right. have been quite an undertaking when you talk about all those people, the food that's needed for them. Plus, we mm-hmm. know there's livestock involved in this as well. You've got to take them. You got to deal with the other side of that. You know, what the waste products that come from that yeah. much livestock yeah. as well. So this is not an easy thing. This is not, you know, just a line of a few hundred people who are traveling together. This is quite an undertaking. And their line, you know, I'm sure they didn't go one by one.
Right. There
would be groups of people beside each other. But still, the length of line for that many people would have been dramatic.
Well, and the track, how easy would it have been to track them? I mean, I can't yeah. imagine. But with that many people, and you have to think they've been enslaved for how many years? They've been overworked. They're not in good health, probably. Unless, correct. And maybe, you know, we talked a couple weeks ago about what was the timeline? How long did it take for these 10 plagues to occur? You know, maybe God was strengthening them physically and getting them ready for this long trek, you know? So it had to be a little bit of time for them to, I mean, I'm not adding to scripture. I'm just thinking as a writer, what must be said.
We're just looking at the history here. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, the other side of that is it would have also weakened the Egyptian army.
Yes, because
they've
says
lost
only,
livestock,
yeah.
because they've lost people, because they had no water, you know, mm-hmm. all those things that would have made it less easy to maintain health. So, you know, and some of those things did not affect the people of Israel, so it would have helped them and hurt the Egyptian army. So
right.
God may have been at work in all that.
Yeah, and by the time these 600,000 plus humans are leaving, it's 600 of Pharaoh's chariots that are coming at yeah. them. And you think, well, that's really not, if you're part of the 600,000, you're thinking, oh, we've got a chance against 600. But they were still fearful. What was that
they
about?
They were. And because you've got a powerful army with powerful weapons. And it says, let's see here. He took 600, this is chapter 14, mm-hmm. Verse 7. He took 600 of the best chariots along with him, all the other chariots of Egypt were the officers over all of them.
Oh.
So the very best is the 600.
Okay.
But then you've also got an unnamed number right. of other chariots. So this 600 would have been a powerful fighting force, even though they're going against a large number of Israelites. But many of them would have been
weakened
unarmed.
And yeah.
You know, not fighters at all, non-combatants,
right.
we might say.
Right, yeah.
So even though the number was small, they would have been very powerful.
Well, and the trauma of being slaves.
Sure.
How much
sure.
fight
they're
do
not
you really
well
have?
Fed,
it? Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how satisfying with all of that being thought of is it to read verse 50 and 51 of chapter 12?
Well, I mean, if you read through these chapters in Exodus, it's like, oh, finally
yeah.
we get there where mm-hmm. the people of Israel leave Egypt. Mm-hmm. On that very day, the Lord brought the Israelites out of Egypt by their divisions. It finally happens. It's the culmination mm-hmm. of going through all these plagues and the culmination of hundreds of years of God's promises finally coming to fruition as they head to the promised land. So all that is finally coming together in a, you know, pretty amazing
right.
way for Israel to get out of Egypt.
Yeah. And I think verse 50, where it says all the Israelites did just what the Lord had commanded Moses right. and Aaron, that has got to be one of the only times that's mentioned in here, that all of Israel.
It doesn't take long for them to all agree on just the opposite.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
This is a bad idea.
So chapter 13 is when Moses is reinforcing everything that God did for them to bring them freedom and to begin their journey toward the promised land. For the Lord brought us out of Egypt by the strength of his hand, is what Exodus 13:16 says. This journey toward the promised land was not a straight shot. It brings several questions to mind. Like I said, they went forward, around, and backward, and ended up in front of the sea. But one of the things that they had to do was consecrate the firstborn of all humans and livestock. What was that about? What's the significance of that?
Well, as we go, we actually talked about this earlier today in a Bible study. We go all the way back to Genesis chapter 4, where Abel offers the first, the best of his flock. And anytime you offer the first, you consecrate the first, you are saying this belongs to God, and I am trusting God to provide what I need from this point on. So it's an act of faith to give God what is first. And I think that's what we're talking about. We take what comes after that. We take the second. We are not going to demand of God the very first thing that he gives us. We're going to give that back to him as an act of worship, but an act of faith and trust as well. So I think that's basically what we have going on here as well. That, and we see this commanded from the Israelites in all the laws that are going to come later on. So this is going to be a theme that we see all the way through the Old Testament, but it's all about faith and trust in my mind.
Because you don't know what's going to come after. You don't know if you're going to have
you've got
a
this
second,
one,
third, or four lamb, fourth
correct.
Lamb. You know you've got this
correct.
One, but you're going to give it. So,
right.
yeah, I think that is a beautiful example of how we are to live our lives with things.
Right.
Why did God lead the Israelites through a longer route? And what does this teach us about divine guidance? And this is in verse 17 and 18 of Exodus 13.
So the most direct route would have taken them through enemy territory. The way that God took them was through desert, but it didn't lead them into the hands of other enemies. And we're told that God said if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God sort of knows the character of these people. He knows that faith and trust are going to be hard. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see that pretty quick as we, even in this story, but certainly as we go forward in the book of Exodus. So God knows his audience, if you will. And so he wants to take them, whatever route will lead them to faith. May not be the shortest, may not be the most direct, might not even be the easiest, but God's going to make sure that he gets them on the right path that will help them maintain faith in him. And this is just one example of probably many others. It's certainly not a direct route all the way through.
I feel like that's the way our lives are still today. There's never a direct.
Can be,
I mean,
right?
Well, not never. There's rarely a direct route from where we are to where we're going to end up in serving God's kingdom, I guess.
Often it is not a straight line. Mm-mm. It is, there are ups and downs and probably things that God shields us from that we don't even know about. It may feel like because of that, things are taking longer than they should.
Yeah.
But we don't always know what God's protecting us from. But the point is, he is active in all that. And we have to trust that God's leading us in the right path.
Right. So verse 21 and 22, by day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way. And by night, a pillar of fire to give them light so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. How significant was it to them to have the visible presence of God in guiding them? How significant was it to their faith just being rescued?
I think we have to put ourselves in their shoes if we can. Mm-hmm. And what we have to remember is this is a little scary, right?
I mean, it would be very scary.
to a place totally unknown mm-hmm. for almost everyone, knowing that at the other end, God has promised a land, but there's people that live in that land. And knowing that in between, it's not like they have houses that they can stop in or motels or, you know, there's a lot of unknowns. And so for them to have a sort of a tangible symbol of the presence of God, which is this pillar, cloud by day, fire by night, is a constant reminder. All they got to do is look up mm-hmm. and they know they're following where God wants them to go. So I think it's huge for them. And boy, there's probably times we wish we had something so real mm-hmm. so that we would know we're going in the right way. I don't know what it might look like, but it might be nice to have something like that. But the point is they needed this because this was a truly an act of faith to set out from the beginning to leave what was familiar for the unfamiliar.
Right. And I think that too. I think it would be so nice if we had that physical guidance. But we have the Holy Spirit inside of us.
Right. So
I would rather have God inside of me than beside me.
Well, and it's equally real, but less tangible.
Yes.
So, I mean, the Spirit of God is part of God himself. And we're promised the presence of the Spirit mm-hmm. of God if we are faith-filled believers in Jesus Christ. So we know that the Spirit is there, but we don't see the Spirit as clearly.
Right. I mean,
there may be times when we recognize the work of the Spirit, but or the prompting of the Spirit, or whatever, you know, word you might want to use there for the right situation. But, well, it's not as easy as just any time you want, you just look up and there's the pillar of cloud. Or mm-hmm. you wake up in the middle of the night and you look out of the tent and there's the pillar of fire to remind you God is with us. Mm-hmm. So it's equally real, just not as tangible as what God used in that day.
And not as easy to see when we look at and see our flaws and our character traits that are not necessarily godlike and but it is there. That's what his grace is for, to cover our mistakes so that we can have that intimacy with him. And I usually am very in awe of them, but lately I've tried to focus on, but God's inside me. He dwells mm-hmm. in me. And so anyway, so here are the Israelites being led away from Egypt after a miraculous event by the very presence of the God who delivered them. There is really no way they can doubt that God's hand is on them and that his favor is for them and that he cares for them and will take care of them. And yet chapter 14 tells a different story. God leads them on an indirect route to camp between Migdol, which means a watchtower. So I assume it was high ground. And the shores of the sea. And I'm not really a battle strategist, but being on the low ground between the enemy and the sea does not sound like a very defendable position.
Well, you don't ever want a large body of water at your back when you're in battle.
Yeah, for sure. So when Pharaoh changes his mind and pursues the Israelites to reclaim them as his slaves, how do the Israelites respond to the Egyptian army? And that's going to be in 14, 11, and 12.
Well, you know, the response is really to Moses and to God.
Right.
The response is, hey, we're better off back in Egypt. And that is a refrain that we hear all the way through Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. Oh, Moses, we were better off back in Egypt. Why did you bring us out here? And this is the first of those. But the problem is they face danger. And then even though they do have the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire, they're questioning whether this was God's plan. We told you we'd rather stay in slavery than come out here. So why did you make us do this? Mm-hmm. So they really do struggle. And it's fear talking, isn't it? I mean, it's, yeah, their backs are literally against the sea here and they have nowhere to go. And Pharaoh's army's right there and they have the power to slaughter them. So what are we going to do? And wouldn't it have been better if we hadn't put ourselves in this position to begin with? Which I can understand. You know, I can understand their fear, but it's this really questioning God and questioning Moses' plan that causes a problem here and causes a problem just all the way through the story.
Yeah. I think that we can relate to that in our lives and in our struggles. And you had mentioned, you know, that we have detours or issues in our lives that we need that seem to be not the way we should be going. And here God has taken them around and about and brought them to this place, kind of a detour to the place he wants them to go. But it's also the path he wants them to take. So,
yeah.
How, you know, how can we face that? How can we accept that? How can we not be upset that our backs are against the sea and, you know, crying out to anyone around us like they did? Why are we here? What are we supposed to do? Why can't it go back to the easy thing? Not maybe easy, but the bad that we know versus the unknown. Why does the unknown fear us so fear it, or
causes fear?
I mean
I think it's a good question, and it's a hard one to answer because we're going to have fear, right? I mean there's there's times when we're going to face fear because of the circumstances of life. We sort of in our church family and extended family, we have several people right now who are facing cancer or who have just come through a cancer battle. Well, you know, you hear that word, it's going to evoke some sense of fear. I don't know how you get around that, whether someone you love. So, I mean, fear is a part of it. The question is, how do we respond to that fear? And I mean, I think the answer is in Moses' response to the people. I mean, Moses has the same fear, right? I mean, if the people of Israel are caught, I mean, who's going to be most wanted?
Right.
It's going to be Moses. I mean, that's the guy that Pharaoh would love to catch and bring back to Egypt and do him away in a ugly and painful way. But he's the one who responds in faith and attempts to lead the people in faith. And so I think turning back to the character and nature of God is always going to be the answer to that really difficult question. Who is the God that we're worshiping and why should we trust him? Those are the kinds of questions we have to ask rather than just the questions of what am I facing and why can't I do anything about it?
Yeah.
And why would God allow it? And what kind of God does allow this?
Right. You know,
there's a place for those questions and they're it's not wrong to ask them. But the question then is, what's the next step?
Right. Moses' answer in verses 13 and 14, I just kind of want to read that for anybody that doesn't have the scriptures in front of them. It says, Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid, stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still."
Yeah. Stand firm and you will see the deliverance of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's a good reminder for us. And I do think that's the key to this whole passage.
Yeah.
That this is the proper response that they need to have. Stand firm and you'll see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today.
Right.
That's what everyone needed to do. God had promised to make them a great nation. Well, if he allows them all to be slaughtered, they're not going to be a great nation.
Right.
So this is a matter of trusting God's promises. God had promised to give them a land. Well, if they're slaughtered on this day, God can't give them a land. God had promised that they would be a blessing to all nations. So if they're slaughtered on this day, they can't be a blessing to all nations. So
Right. What
had God spoken? That should be the thing that carries them through. And I think that's what Moses is reminding them. Stand firm and you'll see God take care and God will keep his promises. And in this case, this is not always the case. You just only need to be still.
Yeah.
Just let God do the work.
Yeah. I think there are times when we face those detours or those difficult, weighty, unexpected and unwanted circumstances and situations. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's when we ask, instead of why did this happen or how did this happen, we can say, should say, can I trust God through this?
Yeah, right. And maybe even why should I trust God through
why
this?
Why should
not
I?
Not in the negative, like why should I trust God? But what is it about God that makes him worthy of my trust?
Well, and a therapist would say, what of this can you change? What can you change by your behavior or by knowledge? Can you change any of it by maybe seeking knowledge or learning more about it and learning how to deal with it? Or is this something that you need to just sit and see what God's going to do in it?
Right.
Because there are so many things that are in our control and so many things that are not in our control.
Right.
And it's recognizing those things, you know, when you simply cannot solve the problem. Like the Israelites, they couldn't solve that problem.
Yeah, there's nowhere to go. You know, I mean, without God doing the miracle that he did, they're caught.
Yep.
And so they have to wait on God to act.
Yeah. And when we can't see our way out of the impossible situation, you know, and in my life, it's usually been grief over something or someone. God's presence, you know, Exodus 14:19, I have to read that, says, then the angel of God who had been traveling in front of Israel's army withdrew and went behind them. The pillar of cloud also moved from in front and stood behind them, coming between the armies of Egypt and Israel. Throughout the night, Throughout the night, the cloud brought darkness to one side and light to the other side. So neither went near the other all night long.
Right.
God takes his presence from before them to behind them. I think sometimes he wants us to not look back and focus on the problem or our past or maybe what brought us here, what we think we could have changed, because we can't change what brought us to a situation. He wants us to see only him and focus only on him so that he can open up a way. He wants our eyes on him in the middle of our grief, in the middle of our loss, in the middle of our impossible circumstance, in the middle of our fear and longing for the way things were before they changed, because that's what the Israelites were doing. They were wanting, in their fear, to go back to slavery.
Well, yeah, they're idealizing something that was horrible, right?
Yes.
But, oh, Well, it was better back there because at least we were, you know, we weren't going to be slaughtered by the army of Egypt. They needed us. So that was, at least we're going to have our lives.
Right.
Well, first of all, you're not trusting that God's going to keep your life, but mm-hmm. you're forgetting the oppression that you faced. And we do that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, most of us can say there was a time when something got bad and we thought, why did we leave what was behind and came to this?
Mm-hmm.
And we romanticize, idealize what came before and make it perfect in our minds when we know good and well
that it wasn't.
It really wasn't.
Right. Yeah. I just kind of want to go read Isaiah 43:15-19. Yeah. This is when the Israelites again were taken into captivity, but this time it was the Babylonians.
Yeah.
And Isaiah is telling the people to remember this moment. He says, this is what the Lord says. He who made a way through the sea, a path through the mighty waters, who drew out the chariots and the horses, the army and reinforcements together, and they lay there never to rise again, extinguished, snuffed out like a wick. Forget the former things. Do not dwell on the past. See, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I am making a way in the wilderness and streams in the wasteland. I think God can make so many beautiful things out of what we see as ugly. The wastelands of our life, the grief, the pits, the despair. He can make beautiful things out of those.
It reminds me of that passage in the New Testament that says, forgetting what is behind and pressing on to what is ahead, you know?
Yes, yes.
It's the same concept really run through. And I mean, Isaiah is referring right back to this passage yes. in particular, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's making a reference to that specific event. But that event is so formative in the story and life of the people of Israel. I mean, without this mm-hmm. moment, I mean, if it goes any other way, they don't survive. We don't even have their story.
Right.
Because it's snuffed out before it really starts. So it has to happen. And so that their understanding of who they were as a people keeps going back to this story over and over and over. So that's why it becomes, you know, important enough for Isaiah to quote hundreds mm-hmm. of years later, this
right.
is who we are because of what God has done.
Right. So you in your sermon said that, I mean, we have the dilemma, can I trust God through this? And
right.
kind of the solution to that dilemma is that trusting God's plan is the heart of faith. We have to have faith in hopeless situations. Did God's presence leave the Israelites in this seemingly hopeless situation?
It probably felt like it in that particular moment.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But we know that God did deliver them. We know that, and you know, it's one of those things we have to remind ourselves. This is not just the power of positive thinking, right? We're not in the optimist club where we just
right.
assume, and I don't mean to criticize anybody who is in the optimist club. That's not my point. But the point is, this is not just general optimism that things will turn
right.
out okay. What this is trust in a powerful, good God. That doesn't mean God always does what we want him to do, or that we can somehow control God and make God do what we want him to do. In fact,
right.
the people of Israel get in trouble when they do that later mm-hmm. on. Try to force God's hand to do things that they want to happen. But we can trust the character and nature of God enough that we know that even if God doesn't make things right today, in the end, they will be made right. God will set things right, and we are looking forward to that.
Right. What did God require of the Israelites? I think we talked about that.
Just be still, right? I mean, in the end, that's really what they have to do, is not panic, is not surrender, is not give up. What they have to do is just
trust him.
Sit and yeah. wait on God to act, which is not easy. I mean, sometimes that's the hardest thing to do, is to just be still. But that's what God required in this day.
He wants us to trust in his faithfulness, not trust in ourselves, not trust in horses, not trust in chariots, but trust in his faithfulness, trust in his peace, in his...
Well, you know, I mean, the passage we didn't talk about is chapter 15. And I mean, in certain Christian traditions, they will read this passage weekly, if not, you know, maybe every other week. But the Song of Moses begins, "I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. Both horse and rider he has hurled into the sea." And the point is, God was more powerful than what seemed like the most powerful thing at work in the moment, which is the Egyptian army. God is greater than that. And that's the God that we worship.
Right. I love that. And Miriam's song after that.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah. Exactly right.
And that's what chapter 15 is, correct? It's Moses' song and Miriam's song, which would be a great way to end. We didn't.
So excuse me. I encourage people to read it. Yeah.
Yeah. What can we do with our detours and our burdens that are too heavy?
I mean, I think trust is still at the heart of this is, again, learning that even though we're not saying, okay, God's going to solve every problem I have, and I'm not going to go through bad times, or I'm not ever going to be afraid, because that's not real. We know that.
Right.
Knowing that this powerful God is with us today and every day, and that we are people of hope because we look past what's going on today. We look past... I mean, Paul could look past the persecution that he was enduring to what God would do in the future and what God was going to do through his example and all those things. So it's seeing that what is going on in this moment is not forever.
Right. And it's not pretending that it's not bad, or that it's not upsetting, or that it's not
absolutely
ugly, that we hate it. It's not pretending that those emotions aren't real.
Yep.
It's trusting in his faithfulness through them. We don't have to do anything but trust that he is a good, good God, and he wants to get us through this.
Yep. Agreed.
Isaiah 54:10 says, "Though the mountains be shaken and the hills be removed, yet my unfailing love for you will not be shaken, nor my covenant of peace be removed, says the Lord, who has compassion on you." Just as we weep and have compassion when our children hurt or when we see bad things happen, so God looks at us and has compassion and hurts for us. He does not want to fail us. He wants to give us peace even in the ugly moments of life. It doesn't mean we don't have to experience those ugly moments, that we don't have to experience grief and loss and maybe job loss or any other things like that that we would grieve over.
Yeah, there's a couple of important words that show up in that verse, Isaiah 54:10. One of them is, "But my loving kindness," and that we're going to talk about that word this coming Sunday. And it becomes a hugely important word in the Old Testament. Loving kindness, my faithfulness. What we're talking about there is God's covenant love.
Yep.
His faithfulness to his promises to us. Mm-hmm. So that is all about God has chosen to deal with us in a particular way, and he will be faithful to the promises that he makes. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, of course, we could carry that into the New Testament with the same kind of covenant that we have. And then he talks about a covenant of peace, and that's shalom, right? So that's God's shalom, God's peace to us. That is such an important word for the people of Israel. They want shalom. They want peace with each other. They want shalom with God. They want peace with God. Mm-hmm. And God promises that, you know, through the covenant, because of the relationship they have. So we'll pick all that up this coming Sunday, as we think about God's relationship with his people and then his relationship with us.
Okay. So can you tell us something new you learned in these scriptures this time through?
Well, I think I had forgotten that whole part of the story where God, the pillar of cloud, moves behind the people to mm-hmm. protect them from the army of Egypt before God opens up the sea.
Yeah,
It's a detail that I'm sure I've read it because I've read this story lots of times, but I just didn't remember. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a pretty important detail, really. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the way they make it through this time. I mean, even if you think about, okay, God opens up the sea. Well, think about the number of people and animals that have to walk through there.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
not going to happen in 5 minutes, you know?
No. Right.
That's going to take some time. So they needed that protection from God in that moment as they, you know, walked in faith through the sea, even though that had to be, we didn't talk about a lot about that, but that had
oh
to be
my
pretty
gosh,
scary
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, a wall of water on either side. Mm-hmm. So that little piece of the story, it just points again to the fact that God was protecting them in this moment and God was faithful to his promises, faithful to his people in a really difficult and scary time.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think is the most significant point for someone who does not read scripture, does not know Christ, does not know God, that's hearing this for the first time, this story?
God's with us. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a simple truth. It's not, I mean, it's profound in its own way, but it's really pretty straightforward. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
God is present. And, you know, the idea that regardless of what we're going through, regardless of our fear, our questions, our doubts, regardless of uncertainty, which is really hard for a lot of people, God is present. And we can yeah. depend on that presence. We can know he's there. And, you know, so many times when things are scary in our lives, they are less scary if we're not by ourselves.
Right.
And so we're surrounded by the presence of God. The good thing is oftentimes with the presence of God, we're also talking about the presence of God's people, mm-hmm. which is important as well. So
yeah.
I think those are things that really do matter and do speak to people because the world can feel pretty lonely at times.
Mm-hmm.
And we need help with that.
Yeah. So what do you think is the most significant point for someone who is seeking to know more about Jesus?
Well, one of the things that,
yeah,
one of the things that Jesus promises is his presence as well,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll be with you to the end of the age. So different people come toward Jesus from different directions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So some come because they've sort of grown up with faith, and that's just from the direction of this is just what I've known. And other people come to faith because of struggles in life and not knowing how to handle some of the really difficult things. And for those people, I think this promise of God's presence really does matter. That, oh, you know what? I'm not facing this addiction alone. I'm not facing this mm-hmm. financial crisis alone. I'm not facing this problem with my kids or my spouse alone. God is there. And okay, God doesn't say he's going to solve everything, but I can trust this God with the things that matter most in my life. And that may be the entry point of faith for some people. And
yeah.
as I said, we all come at it from different directions. It's not the only one,
yeah.
but I think that is one.
So, most significant point for a Christian or someone struggling and in a seemingly hopeless place? Is that the same answer?
I think it's similar.
Presence, yeah.
I mean, it just maybe at a different level though, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when we're coming at it without faith, then it's, wow, I'm totally on my own in this and I don't know what to do with that. Okay, yeah. Well, really, you mean God actually cares about my suffering? Oh, well, yeah. That's an entry point to faith. But if we're coming at this from a perspective of faith, okay, I'm already a follower of Jesus, then that's a different thing. Even though it's the same promise, it's a different thing. It's a reminder of, oh, this same God who has been with me throughout life is still with me. Mm-hmm. And this same God who knows I call myself a Christian and yet I have all these imperfections, he's still not going to abandon me because he's that kind of God.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I think it is the same basic idea, but it probably touches us in slightly different ways depending where we are on our faith journey.
Yes. All right. So, what is next?
Well, we'll talk about the fact that they get through this, and then it's like almost that there's a sigh of, wow, we actually are the army of Egypt has been destroyed. We actually are free. We're on the other side of the sea. Now what? Right. I mean, now what does life look like post slavery in Egypt? Well, there's, you know, so much that answers that question, but in an immediate way, just 3 months later, they're at the foot of Mount Sinai and God is ready to speak to them about that. So that's where we pick up.
All right.
At the beginning of chapter 19. And no, we're not going to cover all of 19 to 31, but we're going to cover some of the big themes that show up, especially in 19, 20 and chapter 24. There's a lot there. So we won't cover it all, but we're going to cover the high points and think about, okay, well, how does that relate to our journey of faith as well?
Okay. All right. Well, I think that it has been a wonderful time talking about all this. Just want to leave everybody with a little positive thought. Psalm 126, verses 5 and 6. Those who sow with tears will reap with songs of joy. Those who go out with weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with them.
Yeah.
And Psalm 40, verse 1 and 2. I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me and heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and mire. He set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. I think that that is really cool to end on a note that we know that God is with us wherever we're at.
Right. And that's why we should keep reading the Psalms.
That's right. I love the Psalms. Okay. So next week, we've got lots of chapters. Hope you guys will listen again.
Lots to cover.
All right. Well, that's it for today. Have a good week, and we'll talk to you next week.
See you next time.